Comrades, welcome. About to begin the first talk of this year's summer school. This is Steve Clayton's first talk of at summer school, although he's done many at West London branch. This is my first talk chairing a meeting, so please keep your heckling to a minimum, and we can get to the pub quicker. Without further ado, here's Steve Clayton on family in class society from Engels to Anti-Oedipus. Thanks.
Good evening, everybody. Am I loud enough? Yeah. Everybody hear me? Okay, well, tonight I'm going to talk about Engels, origin of the family, state, private property. I'm going to talk about hunter-gatherers and primitive communism. I'm going to focus on Alexandra Kollontai, who was obviously a Bolshevist, who wrote a lot about women in class society and in socialism. And I'm going to talk about Wilhelm Reich, also the kibbutz experiment in Israel, R.D. Lang, and then I'm going to finish off on the book called Anti-Oedipus. And then I'm just going to talk briefly about, the family today, reforms about regarding relationships. So I want to start with Philip Larkin. This point, some people, members, comrades will be aware of it. They fuck you up, your mum and dad. They may not mean to, but they do. They fill you with the faults they had and add some extra just for you. But they were fucked up in their turn by fools in old-style hats and coats who half the time were soppy stern and half at one another's throats. Man hands on misery to man, it deepens like a coastal shelf. Get out as early as you can and don't have any kids yourself. And that's a very negative view of things. But I think it sums up really the socialist critique of the family. I mean, Marx, straight away, in the 1844 Paris Manuscript, he talks straight away about marriage being a form of private property, and that woman is the prey and handmaid of communal lust. And basically, Marx thought that the relationship between man and a woman, you could gauge the development in society and where mankind or humanity was as regards that relationship. And in the manifesto, he talks quite clearly about the abolition of the family. The bourgeois family, the family in capitalism, is actually based on capital. He says in the manifesto that the bourgeois scream, he's going to abolish the family and all women will be forced into common prostitution. Well, Marx turns around and says the irony is that women are already in a type of prostitution because of the marriage system. The whole idea of socialism would be to do away with the status of women as mere instruments of production. He says, the bourgeois family will vanish as a matter of course with the vanishing of capital. We in the Socialist Party, back in 1913, I've got a copy of the Socialist Standard from 1913, we're already writing about the family. And the arguments in this article are actually a copy of what Marx says in the manifesto. Basically, that sex nature in woman has been reduced by capitalism to the level of a commodity, and that the degradation of woman as a sex is but a special aspect of the general degradation of humanity. And what we say in our article in 1913 is that in socialism, modern marriage and the present so-called family, like all the legal institutions, with their sordid monetary and proprietary bases, will be relegated to the limbo of the forgotten past. So that's basically a sort of brief introduction. Pictures as well. So there we have Marx and Engels and the family. Engels's origin of the family, private property and the state is basically inspired by Lewis Henry Morgan's Ancient Society. Engels actually really rated this book, and Marx did actually did a lot of work on it, but died before he actually put anything into any print. But Engels thought that the rediscovery of the primitive matriarchal gens as the earliest stage of the patriarchal gens of civilized peoples, has the same importance for anthropology as Darwin's theory of evolution and Marx's theory of surplus value for political economy. This is Lewis Henry Morgan, an American anthropologist. So I'm going to talk briefly about sort of like the primitive communist period. I'm sure comrades know a little bit about it, or maybe know a lot about it. I mean, it's known as the Paleolithic era, it's the old Stone Age, and humanity was living a hunter-gatherer way of life. There was no private property, no classes, there was no money, no state. Everything was produced and consumed in common. And at this time, women were actually held in high esteem. Sexual relationships were basically would have been unregulated. Men were living in polygamy, women in polyandry. Every woman belonged equally to every man, and similarly, every man to every woman. And children, obviously, were common to the whole clan. Richard Lee has written, before the rise of the state and the entrenchment of social inequality, people lived for millennia in small-scale, kin-based social groups in which the core institutions of economic life included collective or common ownership of land and resources, generalised reciprocity in the distribution of food, and relative egalitarian political relations. So not only did brother and sister live as man and wife originally, but sexual relations actually existed between parents and children. So this is prior to the invention of incest. Now, incest is obviously an utmost value for humanity because obviously natural selection, the survival of the tribe. With incest, we have congenital defects, and therefore it was eventually prohibited. But that would have taken a long time. So Marx actually says, in primeval times, a sister was the wife, and that was moral. I'm going to quote from Anti Oedipus, which is really at the end of the talk, but they actually do talk about Freud and his book Totem and Taboo, and he quotes James Frazer's The Golden Bough, which is a study of magic and religion written just prior to the First World War. The law only forbids men to do what their instincts incline them to do. Instead of assuming, therefore, from the legal prohibition of incest that there is a natural aversion to incest, we rather to assume that there is a natural instinct in favour of it. If it is prohibited because it is desired, there's no need to prohibit what is not desired. So what we've got in primitive communism, we've got a maternal clan, a sisterhood of women, and a brotherhood of man, and it's matriarchal, it's matrilinear, a commune. Men and women basically assembled periodically in collective councils to make decisions. There's a primitive sort of natural democracy. And then we've got some sort of artist representation. What Wilhelm Reich actually saw, he saw this primitive communist society, which is matriarchal, where the father had no power. There was no Oedipal complex, so there was no repression. In primitive society, which has a collective and work democratic organisation, the unit is the clan, comprising all the blood relatives of a common mother. Within this clan, there is no other marriage and the loose ties of sexual relationship. Evelyn Reid, in Woman's Evolution from Matriarchal Clan to Patriarchal Family, she describes this sort of society as centred around women, and there was a belief in women having a superior magic, which is demonstrated by their ability to produce children. And men were kept well away from childbirth, and may not even have known where babies came from. Bertolt Ohlmann wrote, for the greater part of human history, the link between sexual intercourse and paternity was not even known. So the first division of labour is that between man and woman for childbearing. Engels actually references and Marx's earlier work in the German ideology. But what happens with the development of humanity is that this sort of like group, sort of like marriage, so to speak, develops into something called a cross-cousin relationship, where it's an agreement between communities and a system of exchange, which was organised by women. And partners still live with their kin, but actually met for sexual intercourse. Evelyn Reid references Malinowski's The Sexual Life of Savages. The pair's interest is limited to the sexual relation only. The couple share a bed in a pairing house or anything else. In the case of a permanent liaison about to lead to marriage, they share it regularly. But they never have meals together and no service to be mutually rendered. They have no obligation to help each other in any way. There is, in short, nothing which constitutes a common marriage. Later, this sort of like a cross-cousin sort of relationship develops into what's known as the pairing family, where pairs cohabit for longer periods and actually go to live as a pairing couple, but they still reside with their maternal kin. Now, this pairing family, I hesitate to call it a family because it's still quite a weak unit in the maternal clan system. And separation, it was very easy because there's no penalties for the wife or the children because everything is sort of catered for communally. The Neolithic Revolution. This is the advent of agriculture. So with the advent of agriculture, we're going to get the transformation, really, from mother right to father right. With farming, we get a surplus product created. Now, communal relations are still continuing, and women still retained influential position. I mean, there's a worship of deities in the guise of the Earth Mother, the goddess of fertility. woman is still the mother, the sister, the wife, the controller of labour and productive means. Men basically came to produce both the food and the tools of production and got ownership rights and control over the surplus. The change really is brought about by the introduction of the plough. The plough replaced the hoe and digging stick as the major agricultural implement, and it turned arable stock farming and stock keeping into a male sphere. The plough relieved women of the most exacting drudgery, but deprived them of their monopoly over the cereal crops and the social status it conferred. Women were central to production as well as reproduction in hunter-gatherer and early agricultural societies, but they are excluded from the sort of production that produces the biggest surplus with the rise of heavy agriculture, and this surplus leads to accumulation of wealth. So basically, the new forms of production encourage the breakdown of the old lineage-based communal forms of organisation. As long as much of food production was carried out by women, it made sense for everyone for land and other means of production to be under the control of lineages running through the female line. With the changed situation, things became dependent on the production on the next generation of males. Engels wrote, "The overthrow of mother right was the world historical defeat of the female sex. The man took command in the home also. The woman was degraded and reduced to servitude. She became the slave of his lust and a mere instrument for the production of his children. This degraded position of the woman, especially conspicuous among the Greeks of the heroic and still more of the classical age, has gradually been palliated and glazed over, and sometimes clothed in a milder form. In no sense has it been abolished." There's Demeter, Greek goddess of agriculture, when you still worship them. There is a play by Aeschylus. Aeschylus, actually, interesting enough, was one of Marx's favourite playwrights. And it's the Oresteia, trilogy. And it's a Greek drama. But basically, it focuses on the decline of mother right and the rise of father right, basically. In the play, Clytemnestra is the wife of Agamemnon. Now, Agamemnon and Clytemnestra have a son, Orestes, and two daughters, Iphigenia and Electra. Now, what happens is Agamemnon sacrifices Iphigenia for the war against Troy and basically abandons the family to go and fight in the Trojan War. So while he's away, his wife, Clytemnestra, takes a lover. Agamemnon returns from the Trojan War with a prophetess, Cassandra, as his concubine. Clytemnestra, kills her husband, Agamemnon. Later, Orestes kills his mother in revenge for her killing his father. Now, Clytemnestra is described in the play as a woman with a man's will. Now, the social world of the Greeks at this time gives every freedom to man, but none to women. She says, "Our whole sex is cursed by men, disenfranchised, scorned and portionless." Now Clytemnestra is a woman in a long line of dramatic figures like Medea, and people will be aware of Hedda Gabler in Ibsen. I think the play is really about the old religion, which is female-based, and the new gods of Olympus, which is basically centred around the male figure of Zeus, and male gods are in the ascendance. Also, the old religion was also about the worship of the dead and also about the powers that live under the earth, and basically the earth. And this is, you know, the earth mother, and that sort of thing. There was also a lot of religious rites which were celebrating the worship of Demeter, we saw in the previous picture. And she was the goddess of the harvest, the grain, fertility of the earth, agriculture. Now, one of the sins in the old religion was shedding of kindred blood. Agamemnon sacrificed his daughter. His daughter is kindred to him, is a sin. Clytemnestra killed Agamemnon. She's not related to Agamemnon. He's her husband. There's no blood relation. It's not a sin. Orestes kills his mother, kindred blood. It's a sin. So on, going by the old religion, she hasn't committed any sin. But when Athena judges the case, she justifies that Orestes is justified in killing his mother. And basically, this is the end of mother right. And basically, the old religion, the supremacy of father right, is finished. Basically, in a dramatic play, they've actually shown that it was right for him to kill his mother. I'll just explain that a bit better. But from Evelyn Reach, she writes about it. She says, "The transition from matrilineal to patriarchy is perhaps best shown in the Greek myth of Orestes. When Orestes is put on trial, the key question is whether he is flesh and blood of his mother, as in matrilineal custom, or is the product of his father's seed, as asserted in patriarchal custom. Luckily for Orestes, the judge is Athena, the goddess of wisdom, who has to accept that she herself was born without a mother. She was plucked out of Zeus's head. thus proving the patriarchal assertion that a mother is not necessary. So Orestes was his father's flesh and blood, and it was okay to kill his mother. Mm. Ah, logic, yeah. But, yeah. Well, that's Evelyn Reed, American Marxist. This guy here from Germany, he wrote a book called Mother Right, all about matriarchy in the ancient world, and it influenced Morgan, who we saw earlier, who wrote Ancient Society, influenced Engels, also people like Otto Gross, who I will refer to briefly later, and Robert Graves, the poet. There's also another myth. I'm sorry, I'm just a bit confused about myths. Lilith, or Ishtar, Babylonian goddess. This is a Hebrew myth, and originally Lilith is supposed to be Adam's first wife, but she was sort of that disappeared from the Bible. Basically, just getting rid of all traces of anything to do with a matrilineal communistic past. I mean, Lilith is the motherless form of the feminine self. She embodies the rejected aspects of the great goddess. And she is, basically, what they say is that she's created from the same earth as Adam, so she's not even created from Adam's spare rib, like patriarchal religion later says. She's actually created from the earth like Adam. And basically, she's not subservient to Adam, and basically she's demonised with the rise of patriarchal religion. I mean, among the remains of prehistoric societies of early Neolithic period, female statuettes abound. I mean, I went to the British Museum this year to see an exhibition on Ice Age art, and it's just female figures everywhere. There is no figures of males from this period of time.
Are they all naked?
I think she's wearing some clothes, actually. Okay, so with civilization, we get the monogamous family. And basically, it's an economic consideration. It's for the man to basically rely on undisputed paternity and ownership of private property. And basically, what comes with it is control, obedience, and fidelity of the wife. Evelyn Reed again, sorry to mention her again, but she says the patriarchal family arose to control and subjugate women in the very same process whereby the state arose to subjugate and control labouring men. Class exploitation and sexual oppression were born together to serve the interests of the private property system. So we've got, in the Greek period, we've got women are degraded on a level with slaves. Basically, Clytemnestra is in competition with a slave, i.e. Cassandra. And if you think about the Trojan War and Helen, the face that launched 1,000 ships, what is it all about? It's about male rights of ownership over a woman. And also in the Athenian family, we had Greek men would obviously amuse themselves with female prostitutes, but also had relationships with young men. So what we have in the beginning of the patriarchal society, I mean, in different sort of cultures, we had veiling and seclusion of women, known as purdah. There would be a cult of virginity, a death penalty for women's adultery and never for men, and there would be organised prostitution, i.e. The establishment of harems and brothels. Interestingly enough, the word family actually is from a Latin word, which actually means slaves of the household. Famulus means a male slave, and famula means a female slave. Make of that what you will, but the whole word refers to slavery. Okay, so I'm going to move up to date now. That's enough on primitive communism and the old year. So, hunter-gatherers today. The Kung San of Southern Africa. I mean, Richard Leakey and Roger Lewin wrote that briefly. Basically, they wrote about there's cooperation between large groups of hunters as a key element in the emergence of human characteristics. Cooperation must be a very basic motivation in human nature. What kind of society is it then, when where working life begins at 15 years of age and finishes at 60, with an average of about 2.5 hours labour each day in between? And they quote Marshall Sahlins, who described it as the original affluent society, where finite needs are satisfied with minimum of effort. Certainly it doesn't appear to be a recipe for an existence that is nasty, brutish and short. Richard Lee, he also has written about the Kung San of the Kalahari Desert. He wrote, there's no formal leadership. It's often an informal leadership that develops out of skill and judgment, and the men fall in with the plans and suggestions of the best hunter or reach agreement among themselves. Forcible compulsion, implicit in power, is non-existent. Authority based on consensus, power based on trust, sexual division of labour is not unequal. Men do the hunting, women do the gathering. There's also in the Kung San of the Kalahari Desert, there's planned births, abortion, and infanticide. You know, I mean, women will kill their very young children if obviously the tribe cannot cope with them. Another group of hunter gatherers, the Trobriand Islanders, who are mentioned in Malinowski's 1929 book and also Wilhelm Reich. As she speaks about them. I mean, this is 1929, but they were a matrilinear society. I'm not saying matriarchal, but matrilinear, in which descent and kinship and every social relationship was legally reckoned through the mother only, and in which women have a considerable share in tribal life, even to the taking of a leading part in economic, ceremonial, and magical activities. They also, the Trobriand Islanders, the father is basically the man married to the mother, and he lives in the same house with her and forms part of the household. Wilhelm Reich sees in the Trobriand Islanders that basically patriarchy and sex negation and class division has invaded the natural state of matriarchy, sex affirmation and primitive communism. Also, Malinowski says that he saw no universal Oedipus complex amongst the islanders. He saw the Trobrianders as warm, open people, relatively free of neuroses of the civilised world. Now, something I did discover, which I had never heard about before, is cultures of multiple fathers. I mean, some people here may have heard about this. Stephen Beckerman and Paul Valentine wrote a book called Cultures of Multiple Fathers, the theory and practice of partible paternity in lowland South America. Basically, the paternity of a woman's baby becomes partitioned among multiple males. The Kanganga tribe in South America. I'll just quote something from a book called Jungle People about them. Klendo's daughter, Patho, is my child, said Wombele. How do you know, said I, since Klendo also lay with her mother. Well, when two men lie with a woman, they just call her child their child. So, but not only do men feel that their mistress's children are their children, but people whose mothers have had intercourse with the same man, whether as lover or husband, regard one another as siblings. Basically, partible paternity is an ancient folk belief capable of supporting effective families. Families that provide satisfactory paternal care of children and manage the successful rearing of children to adulthood. The distributional evidence argues that it's possible to build a biologically and socially competent society. Society whose members do perfectly adequate jobs of reproducing themselves and their social relations with a culture that incorporates a belief in partitioning paternity. I'm going to talk a bit more about hunter-gatherers, but I'm going to talk about basically people may be aware of two-spirit people, basically a mixed gender, transgender, gay people in Native American peoples. I mean, it's been documented in over 130 tribes in North America, the Navajo, the Zuni, the Sioux, Crow, Cheyenne, Mojave, to name a few. I mean, two-spirit peoples is the popular term now, but they used to be known as Berdash. This painting is from the 1840s, and it's called Dance to the Berdash. Berdash is actually a pejorative term, but basically it's a man living as a woman, but actually being celebrated in the tribe. They're also documented in African tribes as well, the Itiso and Konso of East Africa and the Ashanti in West Africa. Basically, two-spirit people had distinct gender and social roles in tribes. They were healers, storytellers, singers, soothsayers, nurses, potters, matchmakers, and they played important roles in ceremonies and basically had relationships with either sex. And there were recognised marriages between men. And this is documented by, you know, basically Europeans going to the New World. Back in the 1540s, a Spanish explorer said, quote, I saw a diabolical thing, and it is that I saw a man married to another. In 1576, another Portuguese explorer was in Brazil, and he observed female Berdash, basically women living as men. In the 1600s, a Jesuit father was voyaging down the Mississippi, and he said, some Illinois, as well as some Nadusi, while still young, assume the garb of women and retain it throughout their lives. This is Wiwa of the Zuni tribe. Now, this is a man living as a woman in the Zuni tribe. He was actually so famous, he actually visited Washington, D.C. and met the President of the United States in the 1880s. And basically, everybody believed he was a woman. He was a transgender man living as a woman. So basically, European civilization brought homophobia, transphobia with it, you know, with this conquistador, with the Catholic Church, Puritan morality, basically. Now, I have a friend who's a filmmaker, and he's a gay man. And he was on holiday in Flagstaff, Arizona, several years ago. And he was in the Monte Vista Lounge Bar, which is in the main town of Flagstaff. And he met with men and women from the Rainbow Navajo group. And basically, they wanted to take him home with them, back to the reservation. And he said to me the other day, they were concerned that the Navajo traditional acceptance of queerness was being eroded by Catholic missionaries to the reservation. So even today, in the 21st century, we've still got Roman Catholic missionaries going in to hunter-gatherer communities. Well, it's not strictly hunter-gatherers anymore, obviously, living on reservations, but they still have elements of that. And they're still trying to change their acceptance of gay people. Very interesting. Right, into the 20th century. Oh, so Navajo women herding sheep. I just discovered these pictures. Not men, but women. Again, Navajo women tending sheep and goats. It looks like Monument Valley. So Emma Goldman, in the early 20th century, basically, I know I'm focusing on women, but, I mean, families, this family and class society, I mean, really, it's going to be a lot about women, this talk. I mean, Emma Goldman said women were bound by the social forces of Puritanism and capitalism. She believed they were condemned to be celibate, a prostitute, or a reckless, incessant breeder of hapless children. She had a very good way with words. She said, "I demand the independence of woman, her right to support herself, to live for herself, to love whomever she pleases, or as many as she pleases. I demand freedom for both sexes, freedom of action, freedom in love, and freedom in motherhood." She wrote a little essay called "The Child and Its Enemies." I'm still going to concentrate on women, but I'm going to move on to like sort of children and basically the upbringing of children as we get into the 20th century now. She wrote about the child and its enemies. "Every institution of our day, the family, the state, our moral codes, sees in every strong, beautiful, uncompromising personality a deadly enemy. Therefore, every effort is being made to cramp human emotion and originality of thought in the individual into a straitjacket from its earliest infancy, or to shape every human being according to one pattern, not into a well-rounded individuality, but into a patient work slave, professional automaton, taxpaying citizen, or righteous moralist." Alexandra Kollontai, you're Bolshevik, basically. After the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917, she was the Commissar of Social Welfare. Basically, she's the first woman government minister in the modern world. She was also leader of the women's section of the Bolshevik Party. I mean, the initial reforms of the immediate years after the Russian Revolution, say before Lenin died. I mean, a lot of these things would have been lip service, but they were obviously passed. There was like full legal independence and equality in marriage, legalisation of abortion, divorce was made easier and cheaper, women were allowed to keep their own property, their own name, alimony was introduced, there was the end of illegitimacy as a legal category, homosexuality was legalised, contraception was introduced, there was a principle of equal pay, state provision of maternity and child healthcare, and so on. Communal kitchens, communal dining rooms, communal housing, laundries, cleaning, and such like. And children were given full legal rights as individuals. But even like a Bolshevik and like Kollontai realised that women's liberation could only take place as a result of the victory of a new social order and economic system. She believed that new sexual relations would be purified of all material elements, of all money considerations. Now, Engels, August Bebel, and Clara Zetkin all seem to believe that freely chosen monogamy as a likely form of future sexual relations, that would be the likely form in the future in socialism. Now, Kollontai is a little bit more radical than that. In two works that I've read, Theses on Communist Morality in the Sphere of Marital Relations and Communism and the Family, she basically has these things to say. I mean, basically, relationships are subject to selfish competition and individualism in capitalism, and they need to be replaced by loving comradeship and cooperation. Women and men in a free union which is strong in comradeship. Let men learn to love women, not for being good at kneading dough, but for their personal qualities, their human ego. I like this touch now. Separation of kitchen from the marriage is a reform no less important than the separation of church and state. So there's a sensitive and comradely love of equals, you know, and partners would retain their own personal integrity and commitment to the collective. She goes on to speak about sexual exclusiveness and an all-embracing love. She seems to oppose an intense love between two people as being against the collective. And she actually believes in that woman must accustom herself to seek and find support in the collective and in society and not from an individual man. And she also is a great believer in some sort of aspects of free love. She says the sexual act is something which is as natural as the other needs of healthy organisms, such as hunger and thirst. I mean, she sees the old family, you know, the bourgeois family, as antisocial, oppressive, it's narrow and petty, and the parents are only interested in their own offspring, and they're not capable of educating the new person, i.e. the Bolshevik new person. Basically, she wants, like, women to basically not differentiate between yours and mine, i.e. between children of some other couple and their own. And remember that they're only our children, and the child can grow up into a conscious communist who recognises the need for solidarity, comradeship, mutual help and loyalty to the collective. And then she actually went on a speaking tour of the USA in 1915. But she had her work cut out because, like, there's a lot of sexual conservatism in the socialist movement. I mean, Lenin spoke with contempt and disgust. He actually said, yellow-beaked fledglings newly hatched from their bourgeois-tainted eggs who preach casual sexual gratification. To be sure, thirst has to be quenched. I think this is a direct reference to her quote. But would a normal person lie down in the gutter and drink from a puddle, or even from a glass whose edge had been greased by many lips? Anyway, she became an executive committee member of the old Russian Congress of the Soviets, and she joined something that was known as the Workers' Opposition. This was an opposition tendency in the Bolshevik Party, which was opposed to the increasing bureaucratisation of the Soviet state. This was banned in 1921, and basically Kollontai was actually sent into diplomatic exile in 1922. She became ambassador to Norway, Sweden, Mexico, the League of Nations, and basically did that right up till about 1945, so she was away from the Soviet Union. And basically, her views on the status of women were marginalised and trivialised. I will talk about briefly about the counter-reforms in the Soviet Union a little bit later. Edward Carpenter, English gay socialist. I mean, he was active from about the 1880s. And again, he linked gay liberation, gay emancipation, to the social transformation of society. He read the SDF leader Heinemann's book, England for All, which is a plagiarisation of Marx's ideas. He met Heinemann and William Morris, donated money to the SDF for their newspaper. I think Heinemann believed he'd actually joined the party, but Carpenter said he didn't join the party. In 1883, he wrote a poem called Towards Democracy, and he believed a time when men and women all over the earth shall ascend and enter into relations with their bodies shall attain freedom and joy. William Morris, Eleanor Marx and Edward Aveling left the SDF in 1885 to form the Socialist League, and actually Edward Carpenter went with them and joined that party. And basically, he's in accord with William Morris. He believes in there should be a longing for free and equal relations, which is denied under capitalism. But later, Edward Carpenter, he's a founding member of the IOP, so he's actually moved away from any of the socialism that we would stand for. Basically, Edward Carpenter advocated sort of a free love, a democracy of personal relationships. He believed in women's emancipation. He basically opposed the bourgeois convention of marriage. He actually lived openly with his working-class lover from Sheffield in a sort of quasi-commune near Sheffield for about 30 years. Now, this is in the period after the Oscar Wilde trial, so he was quite ahead of his time, really. Yeah, we were talking about the Soviet Union and some of the reforms that were actually brought in after the Bolshevik Revolution. But what we have later is that the Women's Department was actually abolished in 1929. Stalin declared that the women's question had been solved. Basically, abortion was then criminalised again in 1936. Homosexuality was criminalised in 1933. And basically, they started eulogising motherhood, awarding medals for how many children a woman could give birth to, you know, order of maternal glory and so forth. And basically, the Soviet family was glorified. There's obviously massive state capitalist industrialisation and basically the strengthening of the family takes place. Free love is denounced as bourgeois. At the same time as this is happening in the Soviet Union, in the Germany we have the rise of the Nazi Party in the Third Reich, and women are basically relegated to Kinder, Kirche and Küche, children, church and kitchen. Again, the family in the Third Reich is glorified and eulogised, and the Nazis call for a preservation of the family against the assaults of cultural Bolshevism and communist free love. Also, paragraphs 175 is extended. This is the penal code that persecuted homosexuals. And basically, that was extended. Homosexuals were imprisoned and killed in concentration camps. I'm looking for time.
Well, right.
Yeah. We'll talk about Freud just briefly. I've actually got into trouble, actually, criticising Freud. There's somebody... I criticised Freud in this article. I wrote a review of an exhibition at the Wellcome Centre on death. And I described him as, according to bourgeois psychoanalyst Sigmund Freud, in his 1930 work, Civilization and Its Discontents, the drive to death, Thanatos, now ruled supreme over Eros, love. He wrote that people need a reality principle to keep the pleasure principle under control, otherwise we'd have anarchy. Wilhelm Reich replied that the reality principle of the capitalist era imposes upon the proletarian a maximum limitation of his needs, and the ruling class is a reality principle which serves the perpetuation of its power. I've had contact with a Freudian Marxist who says Freud isn't a bourgeois psychoanalyst. But I think he is. I think he's an apologist for authoritarianism and reactionary conservative values. In one book, he writes about fathers and leaders. We know that the great majority of people have a stirring need for authority, which it can admire, to which it can submit, and which dominates and sometimes even ill-treats it. Freud did identify that repressed people are good weaklings who later become lost in the crowd that tends to follow painfully the initiative of strong characters. But he never goes on to develop that idea. And he actually believes that the frustration of the sexual impulse is actually necessary for civilization. That quote I've just read from the Social Standard, I was going to read from here, but I've read it from the magazine, direct. So what we've got, we're in the 20th century, we've got psychoanalysis, and I come across a psychoanalyst, a guy quite young, is called Otto Gross. He was a colleague of Freud and Jung's, and he was actually inspired by the book Mother Rights by Bekofen, referenced earlier, and also Engels' Origin of the Family. He wrote, "I am a psychoanalyst, and from my experience, I've gained the insight that the existing order is a bad one. The aim is to initiate a fight against the principles of the family, that is, against the prevailing family of the father right on behalf of the communist mother. The entire structure of civilization since the destruction of the primitive communistic mother right order is false. He called for the dissolution of the father right family by the socializing the care of motherhood." So he sees like family structures in patriarchal society violate the freedom of the individual. And basically, he drafts a theoretical basis for the sexual revolution, a generation before Wilhelm Reich. He basically wants to free the erotic potential of the human being as a precondition for social political emancipation. He said, "The psychology of the unconscious is the philosophy of the revolution." Now, I want to speak more about him. I want to talk about Wilhelm Reich. W.U.R., I'll refer to him as W.U.R., as reference to, let's say, 1972 Yugoslav film, which some comrades may have seen. Mysteries of the Organism. There's the man himself in 1933, Dr. Wilhelm Reich. Basically, the pivotal moment in his life was in Vienna in July 1927. He was actually attending a working class protest against some court decision about like some murder of some social democrats, and basically the courthouse was set on fire, and basically police started shooting the working class demonstrators. And that was it for about 3 hours, and 89 were killed and over 1,000 wounded. And I think it was quite pivotal for Reich. He obviously looking at the police and thinking, well, you see the mechanicalness of the police, the rigidity, the robotic motions of them. And it got him obviously thinking a lot about how can people actually behave like that. Yeah, one of his works is Character Analysis, which was published in 1933. And he says, I think this is when he's at his Marxist period. "Every social order creates those character forms which it needs for its preservation. In class society, the ruling class secures its position with the aid of education and the institution of the family by making its ideology the ruling ideology of all members of the society. It is not merely a matter of imposing ideologies, attitudes and concepts. Rather, it is a matter of deep-reaching process in each new generation or the formation of a psychic structure which corresponds to the existing social order in all strata of the population. Bertolt Ehrman says that the repressive features of family, church and school basically join economic exploitation as major targets of Reich's criticism. I don't want to get too like bogged down in too much psychotherapy, psychoanalysis, really. I mean, basically, what he's saying about the child, the worker, in childhood, the obedience to parents, authority figures, the school, the church, the state, and children are taught to suppress sexual impulses. These rebellious sexual impulses are always accompanied by anxiety, leading to some sort of fear of revolt and fear of sexuality. And basically, this authority, you know, the authoritarian society creates sort of pleasure anxiety in people, and basically it helps secure the existing class structure of society. So he was working in Vienna, and basically he was involved in community psychiatry, basically. He went into the working class districts and basically talked to the men, women and children of the working class about their sexual problems, basically the need for contraception, information about sex and child upbringing. He did realise that progressive sexual legislation would really need a truly socialist society. So he knew that in capitalism that these things were really difficult to achieve. He visited the USSR in 1929, and he saw some of the reforms instigated at the time of Alexander Kollontai. But basically, the pro-family policies I referred to earlier were actually only just around the corner. He did visit a children's collective, which was actually run by a psychoanalyst called Vera Schmidt, and he was quite impressed, and he actually wrote about that a lot in one of his books, The Sexual Revolution. And also, Reich practiced what he preached. His own children lived for one summer and some months during a school year at a children's collective in Berlin in the early 1930s. So at a speech he made in 1930 to the World League for Sexual Reform, he stressed the need for socialism. That would solve the issues of inadequate housing and nourishment, the availability of contraception, abortion, social support for the care and education of children, and the need for a change in marriage and divorce laws. He said, the prevention of neuroses is inconceivable as long as there continues to be family upbringing, and with it, Oedipal conflicts. We regret, of course, the complexity of this problem, but it cannot be helped. The prevention of neuroses begins by excluding from the child his or her own parents, who have proven themselves to be the most unqualified educators. Sexual education of the small child will be put instead into the hands of specially trained personnel who will be less biased. This, however, presupposes the education of society in general. In 1930, he actually moved to Berlin and set up, again, same sort of clinics and helps and counselling for the working class. Again, I must stress here, he set up a German Association for the Proletarian Sex Politics, a very long-winded German name, I won't say it in German, but this is basically an adjunct of the German Communist Party. Again, though, he always realised the incompatibility of this sort of legislation with capitalism. So, him and his wife, Annie Reich, actually wrote three pamphlets which were very, very popular amongst the German working class in the early 1930s. One written by Wilhelm Reich himself was called The Sexual Struggle of Youth, which basically related sexual issues to the class struggle for socialism. His wife wrote When Your Child Asks You, and also a very famous one called The Chalk Triangle, especially sex education for 8 to 12-year-olds interlaced with political messages about capitalism. Fantastic. So, as you know, we're in the early 1930s, so we're coming very close to the Third Reich. Basically, the rise of Hitler and the support for Hitler obviously perplexes Wilhelm Reich. And he wrote a book, which was published in September 1933, so it's a few months after Hitler's advent into power. Basically, in that book, he writes, the family is one of the most important institutions that supports the authoritarian state. It's the central reactionary germ cell. The reproduction of the reactionary and conservative individual takes place there. I mean, he identifies that sexual repression paralyses the rebellious forces because any rebellion is laden with anxiety. I am repeating myself from a bit earlier there, I'm going to quote as well. And basically, he's saying the child has to submit to the structure of the authoritarian military state, which is the family. And this makes it capable of later subordination to the general authoritarian system.